podcast brought to you by the Triad Network. This podcast is designed to share trending topics occurring within the world and our communities and bring them a behavioral and mental health perspective.
Welcome to Behavior Health Today, a Triad production. I'm your host, Dr. Graham Taylor. You know, approximately 13 to 20% of our youth and about 19% of our adults have some form of mental illness, with anxiety and depression disorders being the two most common. In a given year, an estimated 6% of adults have at least one major depressive episode, and 4% of adults have a major depressive episode with severe impairment. Unfortunately, however, less than half of the people who experience a mental health illness in the past year receive mental health care. In terms of identifying mental health issues, I know that my primary care physician colleagues often are the first healthcare professionals to uncover a mental health diagnosis due to their increased accessibility to patients. That's why mental health screenings within the primary care settings is such a vital part of a patient's overall health. Speaking with me today on this topic of mental health screenings within the primary care settings is Dr. Cecily Havert. Cecily is a primary care physician who specializes in women's health with an emphasis on the LGBTQ plus community. She has extensive experience as an educator, training future medical professionals at Georgetown University, and as a public speaker on major public health issues such as anxiety, menopause, and the COVID-19 pandemic. In addition, Cecily regularly contributes to the Second Half podcast, which shares people's stories about the challenges and joys they experience in the second half of life. And she's in the early stages of launching her own podcast called Living Breathing Medicine, which explores the human side of medicine through the storytelling of doctors. Cecily, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. You know, Cecily, share with us a little bit as a physician, how the awareness of mental health issues within primary care settings has developed over the years, and what was the impetus for you folks as physicians to add a screening tool to uncovering mental health issues being presented in a medical presentation?
Yeah, you know, mental health is a major contributor to overall health, physical health as well. And over the years, especially as I went further and further in my practice, I could see just through experience how much the mental health aspect does contribute to physical health. And so by realizing that and realizing also that being sort of first line for a lot of these patients who were really struggling, that it was my job, it was, you know, within a reason to try to help these people and bring awareness and, you know, and try to screen for these issues.
Yeah, it's really good. I'm going to ask you in just a few minutes, maybe some of the screening procedures you go through, maybe even a screening tool that you use. But I like what you're saying. We do know that there is a tightly related fit between mental and physical health, and that untreated, unmanaged behavioral health problems can worsen and even lead to physical illness. How have you seen unrecognized and untreated mental health issues impact and maybe even possibly complicate your patient's medical care?
Oh, yeah, of course. What I find is that their physical health is definitely impacted. I do have several patients who struggle with mental illness and their diabetes, their hypertension. A lot of times they are not able to take care of themselves in the way that they would like to. They don't have the motivation in order to eat correctly, in order to even come to their doctor's appointments and have their lab work done. Sometimes it's too hard or too confusing to remember which medications they need to take. And sometimes it's just a lack of motivation of why do I even need to do this? So, and it's just, it's overwhelming, you know, physical illness, especially diabetes, hypertension, maybe chronic abdominal issues, reflux even, these can be very debilitating. And when you have mental illness on top of this, it almost becomes overwhelming to a point that you almost want to give up.
Yeah, I think what you're raising right there is, you know, people think of depression sometimes, let's just start with that, as somebody who's, you know, under the bed covers, in the dark, can't get out of bed, can't function. Mm-hmm. And for some, that's what depression can look like, maybe a major depressive disorder, you know, severe. And that's what we would kind of categorize that as. But depression, sometimes some of the signs and the symptoms are not that obvious to folks. Things like you just mentioned right there that make medical care more difficult. Things like motivation, energy, lack of focus, struggle with memory, concentration, attention, social isolation. Those are all signs and symptoms of depression, aren't they? And those directly impact one's medical care for themselves, maybe whether it's taking medications on time or bringing things up or even getting to appointments.
It's just being mentally organized. Sometimes exactly. Just a lot of times with, especially with depression, there's a lot of slowing. It's very easy to become overwhelmed. And also irritability. There's a lot of other symptoms that go along with that. And The other thing that really makes helping patients difficult sometimes is that they will present with somatic symptoms, with pain symptoms, and maybe not realize in the beginning, and a lot of times we don't realize as practitioners from the beginning that this actually could be depression, this could be anxiety. And really it takes a while, it's a process. And I found gaining the trust of your patients is really, really important in making it from, you know, point A when they present to you with their abdominal pain to, you know, visit number 26, when you're saying, you know, let's explore how, you know, your mood, how this might be affecting how you're feeling. So it's a process.
Yeah, you know, the primary care companion to the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry cites something very similar to what you're describing. They say that in primary care, more than half of the outpatient medical visits are for somatic complaints, which are often associated, like you're saying, with an underlying depression and anxiety. I heard the number back in the day being up to somewhere around 68% presenting with some mental health related issue coming in the door, presenting as a somatic complaint. So, and folks don't know at times to differentiate between the two. That's why some of these screening tools in a primary care practice can be so very important, rather than just asking, hey, are you depressed or are you anxious? Because people might say no for a number of reasons we can talk about in a second, but what screening tool do you find helpful? And then how do you incorporate that into the visit with the patient themselves?
Well, it depends on the visit, I guess. So as part of our wellness exams or our physical exams, we include a screening for depression and also screening for anxiety. We use the PHQ-9, which is a pretty easy, accessible. One. Yeah, it's a good one. And then the GAD-7 for the anxiety. We have our patients fill out a number of forms for screening, including nutrition, physical activity. So we wanted something that was relatively easy and quick that they could fill out. We also look into drinking and substance abuse. So we also do some CAGE screening, the CAGE screening for heavier or excessive use of that. So for every physical exam for the patient, when they come in, they will be answering those questions. Now, if you've got a patient coming in with headaches or abdominal pain, I mean, we're not going to just throw that screening in their face. Even if you suspect from the beginning that this might be anxiety, or this might be depression, I usually don't go there right away. I think my job as a primary care doctor, as a practitioner, is to listen and is to, recognize that this person is coming to me, they're worried, they're suffering because of these symptoms, and to listen and to validate that.
That's an essential part of that trust building you were talking about a moment ago, isn't it? Expand upon that a wee bit more.
So, as primary care doctors, one of, the attributes or, one of the reasons maybe we go into primary care is because we really do want to develop a relationship with our patients, something that spans sometimes, years and years and years.
Decades.
And in order to have that be an effective relationship, there does have to be mutual trust between the provider and the patient. And so that's something that, doesn't develop right away. Usually, it's not the first or second visit that even happens in, but it's something that, that needs to happen in order for the care to be effective, whether it's mental health care or physical health care. So that's something that at least I truly tried to work on. And I enjoy it. I mean, I love primary care and I love being with my patients. I take care of them and their families and also just being able to have that perspective of, maybe taking care of a partner, maybe taking care of a child of theirs. That helps me understand the whole dynamic. And just by doing that, it does build trust and patients feel that they can talk to you a little bit.
You know, when you say that way too, that trust building and they feel that they can talk to you, you may be the only person that they know to come to talk to. They may not be able to bring it to their family or other people in their lives. And so that role is really a privileged role to be in relationship with them, trusted in that way. And those efforts you're making sound really noteworthy. I also like, as you're talking about this form, a lot of times, as we mentioned earlier, patients may deny depression and may deny anxiety, not knowing again what it looks like, but they will answer a questionnaire. And it's kind of laid out in ways that, you know, I didn't know that being a little more irritable might be a sign of depression. I didn't think about that, or even anxiety. Or I didn't know that kind of a lack of energy might actually be depression. So it sounds like with that questionnaire you're using, the PHQ-9, it allows you to have maybe some conversation to delve a little bit deeper and to see if this is really something here that's of worth taking a look at.
It is. It disarms us a little bit. Yes. Instead of coming right out and saying, are you anxious? Are you depressed? You kind of back down a little bit and just ask some questions that maybe don't seem as threatening, yes, but may also help the patient realize. And another thing just to add in terms of, you know, understanding my relationship with patients is that one thing that I always try to remember is that a lot of times when patients, well, most of the time when patients are coming to me, especially if they're coming to me with a problem, mm-hmm, is they are in an extremely vulnerable place.
Yes.
And I need to recognize, and like you said, it is a privilege to be taking care of patients, for them to come to me in that mm-hmm state. And I have to respect that and approach that in the proper way.
You may be the most trusted person in their life, really. Mm-hmm. To share that with, and I like the idea that you kind of extend that, not just the depression, anxiety, although those are the two most common mental health disorders that people are experiencing, but things like, what is their substance use like? Maybe mm-hmm even issues of safety, whether it's,
absolutely,
you know, are you safe? You know, as a woman, is there domestic violence? Is a child safe? Is an elder safe?
Exactly. And we do safety screening too, as well. Yeah, no, because that is very, very important to understand what type of environment the patient is in.
It sounds like you also too, you look to incorporate the family when appropriate into the discussion, maybe around mental health issues being presented. Tell me just a little bit about that and how you might bring the family in, let's say a child or a young adult presenting with something, and how, if it's appropriate, you can bring the family in around that.
Sure. So, you know, I do take care of adolescents, and, you know, adolescents, they're a lot of fun, actually. You know, they're a challenge, but I actually really, really enjoy taking care of adolescents. I actually have a couple of adolescents that I'm raising as well. So I've got that,
I've got that to go on to.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it can sometimes be tough getting adolescents to talk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, especially if there's that trust barrier that you really have to develop. And sometimes, you know, the only time that I see them is at that wellness exam. And so I have to work pretty hard to develop that trust and sort of get down to their level pretty quickly in order for them to be able to open up and talk to me about that. You know, and if I do get, you know, some discussion going and I have some suspicions, or maybe they'll even admit that they're struggling with anxiety or they're struggling with school or attention. Sometimes they don't usually come out and say, I'm anxious or I'm depressed. It's more of, I just don't want to hang out with my friends anymore. I know, you know, or, you know, all my friends hate me. I mean, there's all these, you know, different conversations you can have. And with my adolescents, I do try to have conversations with them alone without their parents. But I also really encourage them to discuss with their parents if they haven't already. But that takes a little bit of digging as well. You know, what type of relationship do you have with your parent? So you have to also make sure that, you know, assessing their safety is very, very important. But maybe I'm taking care of their mother. Maybe I've known their mom for 15, 20 years. So, you know, I have a little bit of a background. So that can help me in understanding how they were brought up. Maybe I talked with the mom last week, did her physical, and she was telling me how she's stressed out about certain things. So I can understand what's going on in the family.
I really like that idea. There is an art to conversation, isn't there? Mm-hmm.
There is.
And it's not just saying, hey, you didn't check this box, you didn't check this box, or we might even go back over that form. And we might, you know, one of the signs of depression is increased social isolation, withdrawal from others. Mm-hmm. And if that box is not checked, we might still say what you just said right there, you know, how are your friends doing? How are you mm-hmm doing with your peers? I'm not hanging around them quite as much anymore. Okay, red flag. Let's go down that path and kind of get curious. Well, tell me more about that. Asking what, when, and how questions can be a great way just to kind of find a path down that to say, well, help me understand more. What does that look like?
Or exactly.
So when you're when you're at recess or when you're at lunch, where are you sitting and what that's like? So those kinds of questions just naturally and kind of organically, in an artful way that you're describing, Cecily, bring us to maybe a greater understanding and maybe even for them a kind of a greater awareness of, hey, you may not recognize this, but there's some things going on here that we might want to take a look at in a little bit deeper way together as we work. Tell me, when you find in the screening process, you're identifying that maybe there's a mental health issue here, mm-hmm. and maybe it's not a full clinical diagnosis, you know, of something like a clinical depression or clinical anxiety, but maybe some anxiousness and some depressive symptomatology being presented to you. How do you speak with them about, hey, you know what I'm noticing? And I wonder if I can raise this with you. How do you bridge that next part of the conversation from medical into the mental health piece?
Yeah, that can be tricky.
That's the art. Here
comes the art. And a lot of it really depends on where the patient is and understanding. Mm-hmm. So again, you know, take the patient who comes in with abdominal pain and you go through the workup because you deserve to rule out. They deserve, you know, the full workup to rule out there's anything physical going on. Yeah. And sometimes it might take, you know, it's the 20th appointment where I said, well, wow, you know, this has been, we've gone through A, B, and C, we've had this test, we've had that test. And, you know, I'm really reassured that we don't see that there's anything going on here that really, you know, is a relief for me. Is this a relief for you? And yes. See that, but you can sometimes tell there's still something. I said, you know, sometimes, just educating. Sometimes, you know, mood changes in our mood, whether it's anxiety, right. depression, just even stress, the effects that this can have on our body are significant. Yeah. And so there's a little bit of an education process in helping people understand that stress actually, you know, that the mind-body connection, mm-hmm. that there is actually something physical going yes. on. And that's the other thing that, you know, when patients come to me and oh, are you just telling me this is all in my head? Right. You know, when right. they say that. And I said, no, your pain is not in your head. Your pain is real.
Yeah.
I said, but a lot of times your mood, your anxiety, you know, whatever it is that's driving this is turning yeah. up the volume on that. But actually, yeah. but validating and letting them know, no, you're experiencing pain is right. that's very, very important. And for them, just they feel heard that way.
I totally agree with that. I really like the idea that you are acknowledging and validating their pain, but mm-hmm. you're also beginning to say, hey, you know, we're not just body, we're also mind, too, and emotions as well. I worked with a woman one time when I was working in the hospital, and I had to do a test battery on her. And it came to be that she was schizophrenic, is what mm-hmm. it showed. And so I was thinking, how do you break a diagnosis of somebody that's schizophrenic? I was a new, you know, resident. I'm trying to think about how to artfully. And so what I decided to do, I decided to come and talk about, hey, what the test shows is, these are some of the signs and symptoms that you tend to experience and,
yeah.
you know, hallucinations, delusions, et cetera. And it can be scary, et cetera, et cetera. And as I was talking to her, I watched her kind of settle a little bit. And then at the very end, I said, you know, we've got a name for this. This is called schizophrenia. And there was this relief that finally mm-hmm. all these things that she was experiencing actually had a name. And I said, you know what, there's something we can do about this. We can treat this. And so what I'm hearing you do in naming maybe a mental health set of symptoms and maybe even a diagnosis that might go along with it, even if it's an adjustment disorder, people kind of go, oh, so it does, this is real what I'm experiencing, not just in my head.
Exactly.
But it's something real and you can help me treat that. So that validation and that normalization of this. And then if you can bring the context in that they're experiencing, hey, school's tough, COVID's tough, things with parents are tough, this time of age is, you know, time of your life is tough. Those are all validating and normalizing, aren't they?
It is. It is. And I think, yeah, the validating, the normalizing, the removal of the stigma
yes.
of mental illness is also really, really important. You know, it's interesting because I practice in the DC area and yeah. I have a lot of, you know, people with security clearances coming through mm-hmm. and it's tough because they say, you can't diagnose me with this. This can't be it because I'm going to lose my security clearance.
Yes. Yeah.
And so there's a sort of another level of a complicating factor there. So
I remember I worked with the military for a while and the same thing was a challenge.
Yeah.
And so we had to be kind of artful, even in the way that we diagnose things and work with things in our treatment plans, et cetera. And
you do. It's harder to remove the stigma because it's sort of ingrained somewhat in them. But honestly, I think that, you know, the people are a little bit more too concerned about that. I mean, the forms that I fill out basically, and I try to reassure them, I said, so even if you are being treated for, you know, a mild generalized anxiety disorder, you know, the form that I'm going to get will just ask, yeah. is this patient a danger to themselves or others? And that's I will right. answer honestly where you are. And that's it.
Yeah.
I said, everybody's allowed to have anxiety. Everybody's allowed to have these. Just because you work for the government doesn't mean that you can't experience
yeah,
right. this.
Yeah. And I think when you put it that way too, and we can kind of normalize it and validate it, we're basically saying, if we have this contextual understanding and meaning for what you're going through, of course, someone in these kinds of experiences is prone to experience these kinds of symptoms. And so we begin to, like you're saying, kind of validate it, normalize it, but kind of tie it together so it makes sense to them without being so stigmatizing. But that also then helps us understand, hey, if these are the things that are the stressors and put you at risk for some of these mental health issues, mm-hmm. what are also some of the treatment recommendations that we might talk about that can help lessen some of the stress, reduce some of the symptoms? Because all the symptoms are just, you know, a way for our body to say, hey, there's something going on here that you need to address. That's it.
Absolutely. So, absolutely.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Continuing education is both a requirement and a learning opportunity, but finding the right CE provider can be challenging. AATBS, a Triad company, offers continuing education for psychologists, social workers, marriage and family therapists, counselors, and behavior analysts. CE courses are available both individually and as part of our new All Access Pass. All Access Pass provides a library of over 250 unique courses. That's more than 800 hours of CEs, with new courses being added every month. As a special offer, Behavioral Health Today listeners can save 15% on CE purchases. Visit us at aatbs.com/BHT and enter promo code BHT15 during checkout. That's aatbs.com/BHT. Check out our library and check off your CE requirements today.
Absolutely. So, absolutely. And then, you know, and that's a nice segue into, well, what can we do about it?
Yeah.
Because that's always the next big question. And, you know, and it's all about, well, how we've got to find ways to cope, right? Yeah. That's usually how I talk about it, because there's lots of different methods. First, I'll usually talk about things that they can do themselves, you know, meditation, just, you know, recognizing what's stressful in their lives. What can you change at this point? Are there little things you can do? Exercise. Sometimes that's probably one of the most underused right. antidepressants out there. Right. But, you know, recognizing that aspect. And then usually the next step will be, well, what about talking to somebody? And, yes. you know, that involves, you know, usually a psychologist, licensed social worker. I have a lot of connections. I've been practicing in this area for the last 15 years, and I've really gone out of my way to try to connect with a lot of different mental health providers in the area, just so I can assist that patient. Because sometimes also it's like, well, you should go talk to a counselor. And the patient walks out of the office. It's like, well, now what? You
exactly.
know, who do I go see? And it's a scary thing. I'm going to have to reveal so much about myself, and I don't know this person. I guess I'll just go online. So what I like to do is at least be able to offer a couple of names, and sometimes even do an introduction.
Very nice.
Especially one that I feel that they would work well with, and sort of just ease on into that relationship.
Yeah.
So then there's that. And then there's the discussion about medication. And that's usually my number three. And,
so if you refer somebody out, which I love, and I love the idea of saying, hey, to the patient, would you be open if I were to make an introductory call mm-hmm. to let them know, or to then let them know that you're going to be giving them a call? I'll give them your first name, if that's all right. Give them kind of a picture of why I'm sending them over to you. I think that's wonderful. I really do, kind of handing them off in a very personal way. Mm-hmm. And that increases the likelihood that they're going to follow up
Absolutely.
Once they leave our office. So yeah. I love that continuity that you're bringing. With some of the folks you might send out to, refer to, psychologists, LCSW, those folks cannot prescribe. Psychiatrists can, but those practitioners don't. They're more focused Correct. On the therapeutic aspect of the work. Do you ever provide medication management for those patients you refer out to those types of providers?
And
they do the therapy, you do the med management?
Oh, I do the med management all the time. You know, in primary care, we've become very good at managing, especially yes. sort of entry-level anxiety, depression. It's yes. just so prevalent.
Yeah.
It's hard to practice good medicine without being able to address this in some way. So I've become very comfortable with prescribing medications for this. And so that's one reason why I like to know the therapist that they're working with, because I do like to collaborate. I do like to, you know, see how they're doing in therapy. Obviously, the patient has to give permission for us to communicate. Once that's established, then I can continue with that. But then there's a lot of, you know, more back and forth, and the therapist can tell me, yeah, you know, I think that, you know, we might increase in the SSRI might be a good idea at this uh-huh. point. And it's helpful for me to say, hey, you know, I talked to your therapist the other day, and, you know, these are some of the things you're still struggling with. How would you feel about an increase? And so, and the patient also feels a little bit more at ease when they know that everybody is on their team and working for them, which is so important to successfully treating mental illness.
Yeah. That's some great support that they get to experience. You know, we've noticed kind of an increase around COVID with folks mm-hmm. experiencing mental health illness. Just real quick, I want to talk about what you've noticed coming into your practice since COVID has been around. But prior to COVID, were you noticing any kind of an uptick in the presenting of mental health illnesses in your practice?
In general, the area that I practice tends to be pretty intense and stressful working in the Washington, D.C. area. Yeah. In general, I feel like this is a pretty anxiety.
It's just inherent. Yeah.
It's just an inherent. I think... I think especially maybe more so recently, but you know, so yes, there has been an uptick even before the pandemic for lots of different reasons. Mm-hmm. But I think also just being able to recognize anxiety and depression has also maybe made it seem like, oh, the prevalence is up a little bit more just because we're recognizing it. We're talking about it more, at least in my practice, it's something that we're very aware that we want to screen for. So it's out there. But COVID has just sort of put everything to a new level, right? One of the biggest complications from a mental health standpoint is the isolation that it caused. The isolation was huge. The isolation, and I saw it all the way from the elderly, especially I do have patients that are in nursing homes, and they were just shut off. Oh my. From their family members. And a lot of times it was their family members that were keeping them connected, that were keeping them going. And so I saw a huge decline in their mental health, as well as their, you know, just even their dementia. If they had some cognitive difficulties, it was really, really hard. It was hard for the families to see that. They felt completely out of control in being able to help their loved ones in nursing homes. So I saw it from that aspect all the way down to kids who were, you know, kept out of school. And, you know, there were more behavior issues, there were a little bit more acting out, you know, in the adolescence, there was these same types of things, a lot more acting out, and a lot more serious mental illness issues with more anxiety, more depression, suicidal ideation.
Yes.
I haven't had that many conversations, really. It almost seemed like every month you're having a conversation with somebody about this.
Yeah, it's both scary and sad, isn't it, to recognize that folks really had a hard time. You're talking about, you know, the idea of being isolated. I think one of the things that COVID did is it kicked up all four of our existential fears, the idea of control, do I really have it, mortality, being alone, our identity. Yeah. And it kicked up all of those in probably the biggest way anyone's ever going to be experiencing in their life again. They're all underlying there, but COVID just brought it to a level of awareness that's been so hard. Do I really have control over this pandemic? I am really isolated. And what kind of mortality might this, you know, threaten for me? So I agree with those really kicked up in big ways. And we watch people cope or struggle to cope in some very significant ways, including the suicidal ideation that for youth was really significant. That must have been really challenging to watch that come into your office at times.
It was. It was very, very challenging to see, you know, kids or adults or whoever it was. I mean, it was pretty much ran the whole gamut, but who really, you weren't even aware that they were struggling before. And suddenly it just seemed like out of nowhere. Sometimes it was really surprising the people that seemed to struggle the most. Yeah.
As you're talking about youth and screening, it just so happens that in the last 3 weeks, I had someone brought to my practice, a young lady, wonderful young lady, who got identified by her primary care physician through a screening that the parents had no idea, but there was school challenges and some of the things you're describing earlier. And these ideas that if I could not be here, I would choose not to be here. First time ever. And the primary care physician was just awesome and kind of got her arms around this gal and talked about it, normalized it. And now she's in my office doing some of this work. But the youth are particularly challenged in unique ways from that isolation, the control piece, and their coping strategies aren't as well developed at that age, are they?
No, they really aren't. They really aren't. And, you know, in adolescence especially, I mean, this is the age when peers are everything to them and they're developmentally, that's what they're supposed to be doing. Yeah. They're supposed to be engaging with their peers and, you know, understand, you know, realizing what social norms are, and they aren't able to do that. And it's devastating. You can tell that developmentally something was taken away from them.
Yeah.
And they really struggled.
In very necessary ways. I don't think we recognize just how important relationships were to us until they were kind of mandated not to be in. And I think we saw some of the signs of just how much of a struggle that was. You know, I know as we're talking about bringing awareness of mental health into one's overall health, the research shows that the early identification of mental illness not only increases the effectiveness of treatment, but can also reduce long-term personal costs and larger scale healthcare costs. I grew professionally in a hospital setting, and we were acutely aware of the costs within the hospital setting. And what we found, however, though, was that there's a positive impact from psychological interventions on the use of medical services, and that provided evidence for a medical cost offset effect. And actually, what most of the studies are finding is that there is an average savings resulting from implementing psychological interventions to be estimated around 20% in the cost savings. That's pretty significant. Have you found something similar by weaving awareness into and mental health interventions into the cost offsets for your patients or the facilities you work in?
I think so. One of the reasons that I feel it's so important to include mental health screening and awareness and treatment is just because it improves overall health. Mm-hmm. So when I see that my patients who have chronic medical conditions, when their depression is treated adequately, their diabetes gets under much better control. Yes. And so therefore, they are not having the complications leading, you know, from mm-hmm. uncontrolled diabetes. And so they're not seeing the cardiologist. They don't have to see the nephrologist for their kidney failure. Yeah. So I see that, you know, even the use of subspecialists goes down when we're able to keep things under control, but recognizing that having a healthy mental state is so critical and so pivotal to keeping the physical health in check is just something that I wish more people and institutions would understand. You know, as primary care doctors, we see this. Our role is prevention, right? I mean, our role is, you know, whether it's treating the, you know, the mental illness or, you know, treating the high blood pressure, it's all about prevention. Yeah. So for us, we see a lot of cost savings when we can actually treat our patients better.
That's really good. This is a little off script, but have you enjoyed working with your mental health colleagues?
I love it. I absolutely. They're just such a remarkable community to work with. But I also feel that the management and the care that comes out with the collaboration is so much better. So it's better for the patients. They tend to do better, but also my job satisfaction goes up also because, I mean, that's also part of it. When you feel that you're actually successfully helping your patients, it goes up. And I just think it's an exercise in compassion. Being able to work with mental health professionals and working with people who are, you know, having the worst year of their life or the worst, you know, week of their life, whatever it is. But I think I've mentioned this before. I consider it a privilege to work with people who are allowing me in the most vulnerable stages of their lives. Yeah. So I don't take that lightly. And so
clearly you don't.
Yeah.
Well, hey, I can come right back at you. I had a chance. And I still do, but when I was in the hospital, more opportunity. The hospital for psychologists, mental health professionals, it's a candy store of opportunities to work. I had a chance to work with my cardiac colleagues, physicians, respiratory, diabetes programs, like you're talking about. I ran a group there for about 7 years. And I had the most enjoyable interactions and kind of co-treatment approaches with my physician colleagues. And like you said, it makes the work so rewarding. And what a fun team aspect, kind of a nice synergy. And the patient feels so cared for, and the continuity of care, the comprehensive level of care is really noteworthy. So right back at you. I've enjoyed working with you folks as well. It's been really great. Still enjoy it.
Let's keep the collaborations going.
I'm agreeing with you. Well, hey, as we do that, I know we're kind of winding down for today, but I'd love to hear from you some resources that you might recommend folks take a look at, including the Northern Virginia Family Practice that you are a part of. So give us some ideas of some resources, please.
So there's a lot of different resources out there. I usually like to refer to either the .gov or the .org sites. So that's, you know, a good place to go. But, you know, anything in the National Institutes of Health, especially mental health, those sites are fantastic. Even the CDC, I spent a lot of time on the CDC site just because of COVID these days. But during my browsing through that, you know, they really have a lot of great information about mental illness and, you know, just lots of different resources. So that's great. You know, if more information about, you know, where I work in particular, I'm in the Northern Virginia area. I work in Alexandria, Virginia, and I work at Northern Virginia Family Practice. Our website is nvafamilypractice.com. And so you can go and, you know, check out some of our resources and our links. We do a regular town hall meetings. It was something that we started actually during COVID when we really started to feel disconnected with our patients and we wanted to remain connected. So we started the town hall just so the patients would be able to see us on a regular basis and ask us questions. But what we started doing then is started bringing in specialists, and I usually bring in the mental health specialists to come and talk about, you know, coping through COVID. And so those links to those town halls and those videos are on the site. And I'm also starting up a new podcast.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah,
tell us about the podcast.
Yeah. I know, this is so exciting. Yeah. So a colleague of mine, Dr. Natasha Bove, someone I work with at Northern Virginia Family Practice, we are both excited to be launching Living Breathing Medicine. Is what we're calling it. Yeah. And basically they're conversations between doctors about the human side of medicine. And it's more just storytelling and digging into, you know, some of the compassion and empathy and the relationships that we have with patients that keep us going, but just the stories that have touched us the most and how that's changed the way that we practice medicine. So just sort of a
congratulations on that.
Yeah,
thank
you.
That's going to be a wonderful thing for people to come in and listen and listen, you guys have a little fireside chat, it sounds like.
It's a little powwow. Humanizing medicine, you know, it's just, you know, it's great.
That's what it's really all about. You know, for those that are listening also, there is a screening online that I want to give you access to. We're talking about mental health screenings, and if you want to go into your doctor to get one, you can certainly do that. But there's a screening online that you can go get. If you go to helpyourselfhelpothers.org, helpyourselfhelpothers.org, it's a program that screens not only for depression, but also for general anxiety, bipolar disorder, and also post-traumatic stress disorder. So again, helpyourselfhelpothers.org. You know, Cecily, I've read that screening for mental health disorders in primary care settings is as important as screening for high blood pressure, diabetes, and other physical diseases and disorders. And I think this mental health screening within the primary care setting is going to be often the first step that folks take towards getting help. So nicely done in what you're doing in your practice and the hospital setting. And I so appreciate you being on the show today. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
It's been great to have you here. And thanks goes out to you listening in as well. We appreciate you being with us. And we look forward to having you join us next time on Behavioral Health Today.
We appreciate all the support from our community. And if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Tribe Network, all rights reserved.